Hi, and welcome to the Webster University Geneva podcast. I'm Juliana Santholm-Bark. Almost exactly 3 years ago, I launched Meet the Artist, a public lecture and podcast series, a platform that enables artists, academics, art professionals, and sometimes also Webster students and staff to talk about their work and their creative process. To learn more about our program of lectures, please visit the link wcci.webster.ch/events/meet_the_artist. I'm recording today with Yasmin Mehboob Khan and Dr. Sarah Grosso. Yasmin is an undergraduate student who is pursuing a BA in media communications as well as a minor in women and gender studies with a concentration in film studies. Her fierce academic performance recently earned her a place on the dean's list at the university, and her versatile writing skills also include songwriting, as we will be discussing shortly. Sarah is an adjunct professor in both the Media Communications Department and the Communications Management Graduate Program at Webster University in Geneva. Her research is focused on communications, women's rights, gender equality, and legal reform. She is an anthropologist as well as a skilled pianist, at least pianist, maybe other things too, as we will be discussing. I'm so pleased to have you both here to discuss an amazing song with which I'm still in love a month later, an amazing song called Dreamer's Water, which Yasmin, you wrote. Is that accurate?
Yeah, thanks so much for having us on this podcast. So I wrote that song when I was 18 years old at the first university that I went to straight out of high school. And I wrote that in my university dorms very quietly so that I wouldn't disturb the other students who were living with me on my ukulele, only knowing three chords. And I wrote the lyrics and the tune. And the tune and lyrics are the same, but the music was obviously elevated when Sarah composed her piano piece based off of the original chords that I knew on my ukulele.
Wow. So this already opens up, you know, this whole universe of, you know, what collaboration can do, right? I had no idea that this was the backstory. So we're going to discuss the backstory a little bit more today. And the way the song was consumed by me or was discovered by me was that you and Sarah performed this song together at the talent show, or at least it was released in video form last month, and it won the Webster's Got Talent competition on February 18th. So congratulations to you both on this win.
Thank you.
How does it feel to have participated in the talent show in this online format? Sarah.
Okay, so I think at the moment it feels really good to participate in anything because the pandemic has been tough on everybody I know at least. I think that's possibly an understatement. So I really like that we have this opportunity to get together and collaborate and do something. And we've been talking about Webster's Got Talent for a couple of years now. With Yasmin, who I've had the pleasure of teaching on many occasions, given our combined shared interest that we have anyway. And during the process, at some point, we discovered that we had a shared love of music and of kind of similar kinds of music. And I realized that Yasmin is a very talented performer as well, and she has a beautiful singing voice. And I thought it would be a real shame if she didn't get to share this with other people, so that other people could have the opportunity to listen to it. So I first heard Dreamer's Water a couple of years ago, maybe, when she kindly shared that song with me. And the tune has been stuck in my head for a long time. It's, you know, it's like an earworm, right, Juliana? It goes round and round.
I couldn't agree more. Yeah, absolutely.
So when I started teaching Yasmin again, and the talent contest came up, we've always been joking like, okay, let's do something, right? We should do something for Webster's Got Talent. And I think the approach was a bit, okay, I'll do it if you do it. Because sometimes it's just more motivating to do something with somebody else, right? It helps to inspire you and maybe to give you a little bit more courage rather than doing something by yourself. So my first thought was, how about Dreamer's Water? How About Tumorous Water, because it's such a beautiful song and I thought other people just might like it too. And it's also, it's hers and a great showcase for her talent. So I just wanted other people to hear it. That wasn't the question you asked me at all, was it?
It got the conversation started, which is the main thing. That's amazing to hear that you'd sort of played such a huge mentoring role there. And such a nice example of a collaboration between student and faculty as well, which is something that should happen more often at Webster. You know, it's really community building and it brings different people together. And when it happens over music, it's really lovely. But the song has become almost sacrosanct. And so I've been really scared about preparing this conversation today because you know how it is when you don't want to overanalyze to destroy anything. You know what I mean? Like you want to let art remain art, and the idea of the aura of an artwork is something that I actually believe in. So I sort of struggle with that as an art historian, like how much, you know, how much do we analyze versus how much do we just worship or just you know, just enjoy, right? But it had a really powerful effect on me. It made me want to write. And so I thought it would be nice to have this conversation today because I very rarely feel such an impact. And this song just made me want to write. And I just couldn't stop writing until the piece was quasi done. The piece that I sent you that will be published hopefully soon in 78 Magazine, which is a publication which the students in the media communications program are in charge. So I just, you know, this conversation is kind of like a tribute to the song, really, that I wanted to do. And I thought, oh, well, you know, you're artists, so why not do this podcast?
I wade knee deep in dreamer's water. Fountain where they keep their coins, wishing for a better future. I wait knee deep in dreamer's water. I feel helplessly pulled by the current of time, where instant is there and then gone. I only ever feel that time stands still when I'm in your arms where I belong. When I met you, I was past dreaming, but guess a dreamer tossed a coin for me. 'Cause just look at how lucky a girl can be. I wade knee-deep in dreamer's water, at the fountain where they keep their coins, wishing for a better future. I wade knee-deep in dreamer's water. Helplessly drawn to the current of times. There's just so much that I wanna fix, but I just never feel that my efforts are real, 'cause I'm small and the world's so big. But I tell myself I should keep dreaming, like the dreamer tossed a coin for me. 'Cause maybe I'll end up lucky. I wade knee deep in dreamer's water, at the fountain where they keep their coins, wishing for a better future. I wade knee deep in dreamer's water.
So I thought we might discuss three things. First of all, to talk about the song's origins, which Yasmin already talked about a tiny bit, but you know, to hear more about the lyrics and how, Yasmin, you came up with these beautiful lyrics and how the lyrics interface with the musical parts, you know, maybe we could talk about that more. And then to hear more about this collaboration, which Sarah, you just mentioned, and how it may have affected the song and your sense of creativity as creative people. And lastly, I wanted to talk about the video production work that went into the song. So Yasmin, I've known about your interest in writing and video production for some time, because I remember going to first year seminar when you were in Joe Peary's class and seeing that video that you produced at the end of that, or in the middle of that seminar, actually, because this was like the midterm exam part of the seminar, I think. You created a video, which was very nice. But your musical talent as a songwriter and singer really took me and probably some others in the Webster community completely by surprise. So I was going to ask you, so, you know, building on what you already told us, have you written any other songs?
Yeah, so music and writing were always really big parts of my upbringing, more than film, actually, which is why it's always interesting for me to see how like my creativity has changed over the years as well. So I started writing songs when I was a teenager, I think maybe like 13 and 14. And that was sort of the peak years as well of my songwriting. So some of the songs that I still sing now are the ones that I wrote when I was a teenager, like Dreamer's Water, which I wrote when I was 18. And there's definitely a couple of songs which are sort of like my family's favorites or my friends' favorites, but I've never really gone about publishing my music or sharing it with a lot of people, except for a couple of my professors, of whom Sarah was one of them. And Dreamer's Water is funny because it's one that I sort of wrote not with a lot of ideas of where it would go. Like my songwriting process is sort of just like get what's on your head onto a piece of paper. And so I didn't really have any idea that it would come back up again, or that I would feel like it was relevant, or the lyrics were still relevant to me a couple of years later. And when Sarah said, let's do that one, I just sort of went like, okay, because I was so nervous about Webster's Got Talent. I was just going to let her guide me through the whole thing. And she chose that one. And I find that really interesting because it's not necessarily the one that I would have thought was like, you know, worth a talent show. And I think that together we made it something that was worth sharing and still relevant. But so yeah, it's definitely been something that I like doing and that I've always liked doing is singing and songwriting.
And so we'll talk about, it's hard to talk about just the lyrics without thinking of the music, but I was just reflecting earlier on how the musicality and the textuality part each perform such a powerful role in the song, and they seem to be at a perfect balance. Neither is really fighting the other. They sort of work harmoniously together. So, when you were composing your song on ukulele, as we just found out, did the lyrics come first or did the music come first? How did that happen?
It's interesting because I think a lot of people first write lyrics, especially when they're primarily writers, which I think I am at my core. But for me, it's always the like melodies that come first. So I was sort of strumming various different combinations of the only three chords I knew on the ukulele, and I came up with this melody, and then the writing comes after that for me.
Okay. Yeah, so yeah, that's really interesting to know. And it has a really engaging storyteller figure, so this narrator person. So looking at thinking of the lyrics, right? So we want to follow this narrator in the song, and you know, there's a bit of a plot, right? So we sort of want to figure out like, oh, what are the coins? And you know, it's sort of very engaging. So it's a great piece of storytelling because it makes you want to find out more and, you know, understand more about this narrator who's telling us this story. And its strength is very much a sort of open-ended quality. right? So it's power to suggest rather than to tell. So I don't want to analyze, overanalyze, as I said earlier, because I want to make sure to preserve the music's aura or the lyrics' aura. But I was wondering about how you had learned the ropes of storytelling. Have there been any texts or songs or even visual examples of storytelling that have had a particularly strong impact on you? And you mentioned your teenage years as being the beginnings of you as a writer. So I don't know. What are your thoughts on that? Any powerful pieces of storytelling? Or how did you learn to become a storyteller?
So I think it's funny because only this year I've realized that that's the word that describes all the different things that I enjoy doing best is storytelling. I think that my family and the way that I was raised was very much based on storytelling. We were always a family that went to museums, saw movies together, read books together. And so it's always been something that I just took for granted and didn't realize is actually a huge part of what makes me me. But specifically in terms of songwriting and why my teenage years were so formative in that type of storytelling, it was definitely when I watched Juno and I listened to the soundtrack of Juno, which is very much either folk or like anti-folk music, which is so lyrical and so much a storytelling type of form that I got really inspired to do that too, especially because it was very different from the kind of music that I had been taught, because I had musical theater training when I was a kid for almost like a decade. And that's so much on technique and the actual muscle of your voice and the way that you can push that and belt as loud as you can and project as much as you can. And when I watched Juno and listened to the soundtrack, it was just this very stripped back type of music, which was like at its core about storytelling more so than about the musical side of it, which just enhanced the storytelling rather than being the prominent figure in the composition. And I was really appealed by that because it was a way to tell a story and make a song sort of free from judgment. And that's what Dreamer's Water was as well. Like, it's not about hitting the right note or, you know, being as like much of a nightingale as you can be. It's just about the story, like you said. And I think that those teenage years were really formative for me because it's such a turbulent time for anyone to go through. And it's so refreshing to be able to process all of those feelings in a way that is free from judgment. And so songwriting in that sort of style was where I found my catharsis.
So I saw Sarah taking a note of Juno. We're going to go and show this movie to our students. To see if it has a positive effect. Storytelling has become such an overused word, right? At the same time, like companies are all using it now. It's social media, you know, what you're supposed to do is tell stories, right? So it's just, I was actually thinking of students and maybe some business students, you know, who sometimes resist this idea of storytelling and learning about how to do it. Do you have any advice to me and Sarah for helping business students learn about storytelling?
Ooh, to put myself in the shoes of a business student is challenging because it's so far away from what I do. I don't know. I guess it's definitely the best thing ever is if there is a type of media they like, whether it's a book, a song, or a film, and you get them on that hook and make them just break it down and realize what the storytelling aspect is. Because I mean, they might have this image of like, you know, cavemen sitting around a campfire trying to communicate with one another. And like, that's not necessarily what it has to be. So find something they like anyways. Half the time, I think people like things because of the story without even realizing it. And maybe that can translate into something that they like doing.
Yeah. So the idea of taking the plot, starting with plot, and then sort of breaking down into maybe looking at some of the formal aspects afterwards, right? So yeah, thanks. We'll apply that, right, Sarah?
Or just watch Juno, because that's just such a great movie and everyone likes it.
Yeah. Your lyrics are both personal and are also directed towards the outside world, right? So this is autobiographical quality, but you mentioned the current of times, right, to quote. And they suggest a willingness to improve the world. And that sort of got me thinking about whether it's important for you that art be a kind of form of activism. Is this something you think about?
Yeah, I think all art is a product of its time. And I think it's very difficult to do that in a way that isn't somehow a sort of social commentary or something to do with activism. So I think even pieces that are supposedly apolitical can sometimes tell you a lot about what was going on at that time. And for me, rather than have it just be something incidental and just contextual, I do put it at the forefront of the products that I create, whether it's in writing or in music or in film. For me personally, that's very important. And I hope that it's important for other people. But even if it isn't, I think they can't escape from it. Like, there's going to be some sort of commentary and opinion in any art that you make.
Yeah. I was listening to Ai Weiwei's interview that was a part of the festival, Le Festival du Film des Droits Humains, which just ended yesterday in Geneva. And at one point, so this is a great Chinese artist, right, who's been considered a dissident by his government. And he, at one point during the interview, he said, sorry, I'm paraphrasing, because he was probably thinking Chinese when he said this, but to paraphrase what he said, I think that artists should be fighters in both the ethical sense and also the aesthetic sense. Artists cannot separate themselves from the human struggle. So that's kind of related to what you just said about artistry. It can't just be a person sitting in a studio or her studio painting and not interacting socially with other people and engaging with issues of our time. So yeah,
exactly.
Sarah, did you have any thoughts on artistry in this engaged sense as an anthropologist?
Well, it's interesting.
Or not, or just as a person.
Or just as a person. I think an anthropologist is who I am as a person anyway, because
right.
It's all about, I was drawn to that because it's all about observing and trying to understand the world we're living in and the human condition, and then feeding that back, right? Expressing that in some way. As an anthropologist, that's in the form of ethnography, but that can also be as a songwriter in the form of a song. So for me, like, Yasmin is doing kind of like anthropology, right? It's a way of reflecting the world. And yeah, it's commenting on the state the world is in, the form of activism. Yes, maybe it is. And they're certainly the artists I'm drawn to are often very engaged in different ways. So I think that is important to have a voice as well. Then maybe we can choose. Sometimes I think it's good for us to work through the issues ourselves on a personal basis, you know, in a private way, which is maybe what I do, maybe what Yasmin is doing at the moment at least. But then we can choose to make that more public, right? As a way to connect with people and maybe just get people to think about an issue that's got to be a starting point to doing anything about it.
Yeah, who are some artists that you look at for inspiration, Sarah?
Yeah, we're smiling at each other for those who can't see us because Juliana knows very well who some of my favorite singers are. And one of my favorite singers, I'm often inspired by singer-songwriters because I have a lot of respect for people who do compose their own music and who are also talented musicians. And I find a lot of inspiration. And one of my favorite singers is a woman called Tori Amos, who does put a lot of activism into her work and consciously does so and cannot do otherwise. And I think as Yasmin was saying as well, it's a reflection of the world we're living in. So she's very anthropological. I know that when she tours, she spends a lot of time talking to people and listening to people. And then her songs will be inspired by the conversations that she has. And then those songs will inspire other conversations that will inspire new songs. And there's something quite beautiful about that process because it's a dialogue, right? It's an exchange. It's not just a kind of one-way communication or a kind of top-down communication. There's a real kind of reciprocity there, which is quite beautiful. So this creative process of kind of, you know, gathering data and then expressing it in some way is something that really has inspired me for writing music, but also for writing other things like classes, courses I'm teaching, or research papers, or PhD thesis at a certain point of time, or a senior overview, just to give an example of the kind of thing Yasmin's doing hers. And she'll do it very well too, that we can write. So I had taught aspects of that creative process to students before, as a way in to doing tasks that can seem challenging, to make it seem more like a dynamic process. So she's definitely one singer that's inspired me. I'm really drawn to these female singer-songwriters like Tori, like Joni Mitchell as well, who are, you know, engaged and have something to say about the world we're living in, and who make us think. You know.
So, since you sort of started talking about collaboration just now, I wanted to ask you whether this, how did the idea of a collaboration between the two of you emerge? Was it the talent show, or did that sort of happen before? Yasmin.
So Sarah she is also part of a band and composes her own music. And so we sort of sneakily, this was sort of this buildup of sharing work with one another. And we sneakily became like each other's fans. So I've been following Sarah's music and the music that she composes with her band. And Sarah's been given exclusive access along with like my grandfather and my mom to my SoundCloud, where I put my music up. So we've sort of been observing each other. And we always sort of said, it's interesting that we have similar styles, and it would be cool in a very abstract sense to one day do something together. But I'm a pretty stubborn person and not nearly as outgoing as I would like to be. And so there's always been this sort of block whenever it's sort of Webster's Got Talent season. Sarah sort of goes, oh, is this the year that we're going to do something? And I always go, no. And then next year she asks again, and I still say, no. But this year, since it was virtual, she caught me and she's like, hey, if you don't do it this year and it's your last year at Webster, we're never going to do this. And I think that we were both in a period of sort of creative rut, like we weren't feeling really great and not very creative. And so this was a really fun way for us to motivate one another. But it was definitely sort of this like, it was sort of this like foreshadowing that eventually we would collaborate on something, but we never quite knew when Yasmin was going to give in and actually do it. And then I did. So that happened. Yeah.
I was so happy to do this with you. I mean, like you say, it had been a long winter. So mostly I was doing this for you, honestly, because I really think it would be just a crying shame for other people never to hear your music and your voice. So I think I also, it's like I'm doing it for 20-year-old me as well, you know, though I don't have your talent, my dear, to give you the courage that I wish I'd had 20 years ago. Do you know what I mean? Sometimes we just need a little small lift to see that actually, you know what, if you do it, it's not so bad, and actually it can go really well, and other people will like it. And guess what? They did. I didn't think we would win this at all. I had no idea that would happen. That's just an added bonus. For me, it was more like on a selfish level to do something really fun with you. And that was really inspiring. And it got me out of my rut as well. I started writing again. It did me the power of good. And Yasmin sent me the video that she just finished. And after it had come together beautifully under her loving editing. And I just thought, and I think I said to you, we did a good thing. You know, we did a nice thing. Now, and that's the beauty, right? It's not for fame, glory. It's just collaborating with somebody you respect and you trust to make something, to create something. And in these times, it's valuable. And hopefully giving you a bit of confidence to do it along the way.
That's a really nice thing to hear. I'd be kind of curious to hear a version of the song in its original form. Because I feel like, you know, my next question is sort of something like, how did the collaboration transform the song as it existed before it got transformed? So I don't know if we can play a version of it on this podcast, you know, just hear the collaborative version, but then also hear the first version maybe. But so my question is how did the collaboration transform the song? So I understand quite a lot. So maybe you could talk about musically what happened. So
I just wanted to say,
yeah,
I wanted to say that for me, she could absolutely have done this by herself. For me, the ukulele version was beautiful, and there's a simplicity to it that I really like. So she could have easily just run with that, made her video. But I'm also at the same time very happy that you didn't. But there's, I think it's in the simplicity of it that it's, that's where the beauty comes from as well.
Yeah, I'm shaking my head and wagging my finger for those who can't see me. For me, Sarah was just the yin to my yang, like we had to do this together. But I can definitely let you hear the original song, and I think it will speak to the fact that collaborating did elevate it and make it something quite ethereal and beautiful in comparison to the sort of rough ukulele chords that I originally had. I don't know if, do you want me to like play it right now, or should I send it to you as a file?
I mean, we'll definitely do a proper editing job and insert it if I could, because I want the audio to be good. And hopefully the sound of our voices through Zoom is not so bad. But I would love to say, yes, let's hear it now. And we can always edit it out later if it's, is it possible?
Yeah.
So we can talk about how the two versions compare. That'd be great.
Yeah, let's do that.
I wade knee-deep in dreamer's water, at the fountain where they keep their coins, wishing for a better future. I wade knee-deep in dreamer's water. Helplessly pulled by the current of time, where every instant is there and then gone. I only ever feel the time stand still when I'm in your arms where I belong. When I met you, I was past dreaming, but guess a dreamer tossed a coin for me. 'Cause just look at how lucky a girl can be. I wade knee-deep in dreamer's water, at the fountain where they keep their coins, wishing for a better future. I wade knee-deep in dreamer's water. Drawn to the current times, there's just so much that I wanna fix, but I just never feel that my efforts are real, 'cause I'm small and the world's so big. But I tell myself I should keep dreaming, like the dreamer tossed a coin for me, 'cause maybe I'll end up lucky. I wade knee-deep in dreamer's water, at the fountain where they keep their coins, wishing for a better future. I wade knee-deep in dreamer's water.
That's difficult to listen to sometimes because I feel like the ukulele wasn't even in tune, but it's okay.
It was wonderful to hear that first version. Thank you for sharing that with us.
Thanks
so so it's quite a bit different from the second version. So let's talk about, you know, let's talk about the piano.
Oh.
Where'd you get that piano sound, Sarah?
Well, from playing a piano. I play piano, so I wasn't going to be doing anything else. So that's what I could propose. And something I've always done is accompany. And it's a different thing to do. And it's something I've always enjoyed doing. So when I was at school, from age 12, I accompanied the school choir, and I was pianist for the orchestra. And then, you know, my friends, like if they were singing a solo or something in like the Christmas concert or something like that, they would ask me to accompany them. And I would accompany, you know, an 11-year-old trying to play clarinet, etc., etc. And it's a different way of playing, because if you accompany well, the people shouldn't think so much about what you're doing with piano. You're supposed to showcase the voice or showcase the 11-year-old playing clarinet. Now, luckily, we're showcasing the voice. So my goal was to play something that would be supportive and relatively simple for Yasmin to sing over, because COVID, we had to do this virtually and asynchronously, right? So we didn't have the luxury of maybe in other times we could have got together around a piano and actually started to try and like work on it live, like together, to see how it could come together. So we had the constraints of like time, and my goal was to play something to showcase her voice and to make it as easy as possible, because I knew she would then have to record on top. So I had my son make me like, okay, put this ukulele thing on GarageBand, and then I could listen to it in a headset and play over. And with the goal that I wanted to do something quite regular and structured enough that, you know, to keep the time, basically. Had we played it live, I might do it a bit differently. And I want to try that one day, by the way, Yasmin, we should do that. And then I stripped the ukulele track off the GarageBand and I sang over so that she would have a clean version with piano and voice, so that she could then record her own vocal on top. And as a bit of fun, I recorded some backing vocals just because, you know, for the hell of it, basically. But my goal was to give her something that she could just sing over, so that it would be relatively straightforward and be supportive of her, basically.
Isn't she amazing?
She's amazing. You're both amazing, because you refuse to take the credit from the other person, which is a big love fest, really. But I mean, go ahead.
Sorry, that's the thing with Zoom and turn taking. For me, a big thing is basically trust, right? You have to trust each other. It's like, okay, I'm going to record something. You trust me to do that with your song. That's already huge. And then I'm bouncing it back to her, and I trust that she's going to do like her thing, and that, you know, I know that she can edit. I know she can do sound. I know she can do film and stuff. So my goal was to provide her with materials to turn it into something, and that she would mix it all together, which she did beautifully. But it has to rely on, in a sense, you know, trust as being the key, and listening as well, like listening to one another, but with that distance there as well. And it reminds me of when you hear people talking about people who do improvisation in comedy or theatre as well. You're kind of bouncing off each other and in a place of trust and acceptance as well. And being like, okay, you're going to do that. Okay, how can I reply to that? How can I be supportive of you and your idea? Okay, I'm going to reply like this. You know what I mean? So it's this kind of exchange, but you have to have kind of a relationship to build that upon, which is a nice thing in itself. So we can learn from this kind of collaboration, I think, in many different areas of life, not just to do music, but for the business students as well. You know, a lot of people can learn from that kind of experience.
It's so true. It was such a yes and moment. Like it was really like, here's my music, and you're like, okay, cool. Here's mine. And I'll be like, okay, cool. And I'll add to that. Like there was no, we didn't really create a strict set of guidelines in terms of what we wanted the outcome to be. We just let it evolve and flourish into what it became when we each added our own thing to it.
Yeah. It's really interesting to hear you talk about how you just collaborated like this, and how I think, I mean, thinking back to the sound of ukulele and voice, I mean, there's a lot more cheerful, right, in that first version. It's sort of minstrelish, right? It's kind of cheerful. And then the piano, just thinking to what it brings to the piece. And it's so interesting to hear this backstory, but it's so resonant and it's sort of amplifies, it sets the stage for the voice, as you said, Sarah. And it works so, so well. And but it adds a sort of drama to the song as well. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I definitely felt that. I remember it's hard for me to imagine any of my songs being on any instrument apart from the ukulele, because like you said, like the style is so restricted by what I know how to do. And so it's always very sort of uplifting, like it sort of sounds, like a simple ukulele song. So I couldn't imagine how it would translate onto the piano. And I trusted Sarah to do something wonderful, but I had no expectations of what it would be. And I remember when I listened to it for the first time, I just thought like, whoa, this sounds like the essence of the song. It just makes it a little bit more dreamy, a little bit more nostalgic too. And it, I don't know, it really captured, I think, the essence of it. And I really do think that it made it wonderful. And I don't think that I could have done it on the ukulele in the same way. It's also such a, you really get that sense of support in the accompaniment, like Sarah said, like it just feels very complimentary. And it's interesting to hear because we recorded them separately. We composed them separately. The song itself was written years before we did this together. So it's really interesting to me that the piano actually creates this like unifying experience of a song that was completely compartmentalized in its production. I definitely think it adds to the piece.
And then we have to talk about the voice, right? So it's the multi-voice thing that's going on. Is that your voice or is that Sarah's voice? The backing vocals, who did those? It's Sarah, right?
It's
according
all
to the video.
It's all three of us. It's me, second me, and Sarah.
Oh, wow. Okay. So that's something that's not immediately obvious from watching the video, although we know that there's Sarah there because she's singing in the video, unless that's a falsification of reality. But so how did you come up with that? Because that adds resonance as well, right? So we have primary voice, we have the piano, but then we have these backing vocals, which add another layer, which makes the song even more powerful. So how did you come about adding that to the track, to the song?
I think for me, it's just, I don't really sit down and compose stuff. That's not how that works for me. Ideas come to me and I sit down and I'm drawn to play something. So when I hear this song, I hear harmonies, right? So like, it's like if I'm listening to it myself, I would kind of sing along in my house or whatever it is. If my son has put it on, then I might sing along, right? My son cooking the dinner. So for a bit of fun, after I recorded the piano and the kind of main vocal to track for Yasmin, I thought, okay, I'm just going to sing some harmonies. I think probably also we both love music and probably harmonizing is something that comes relatively easily, I'm guessing, to Yasmin as well. So it's just, you know, adding depth in some certain places or emphasizing certain points. But for me also the harmonies then emphasize the silences. So when the harmonies dip out, then you hear this kind of clear lead vocal coming back in, and that's really beautiful. So sometimes it's the silence around something that really makes it stand out. So I know Yasmin.
Yeah. No, I think that's a really good way of putting that process of adding multiple vocals. For me, it's also, like you said about passion for music, I was trained in musical theater. And so I sort of notoriously harmonize to everything and anything all the time, much to my family's dismay. So that's sort of something that I just instinctively do. And you guys were lucky because sometimes I can go way over the top and it's like there's six vocals of me just harmonizing to every single aspect of the melody. But it was also the fact that when Sarah did send me her piano track the first time with her guidance vocals, it was an incredible experience to hear someone else singing something that I had written in such a personal and like isolationist kind of way. And I was so in awe of the fact that I was hearing what I considered to be like almost a diary entry, like my words being sung by somebody else. And I didn't want to give that up. So actually the first version that I edited was like full on like duet, like me and Sarah, our vocals, same level of like participation in the song. And Sarah encouraged me to like strip it back and make it more one lead vocal. But I definitely did not want to compromise on having Sarah's voice and my own and my like other voices as well on the piece, because it just felt so much more complete that way.
I was going to ask you, so you mentioned earlier that your collaboration occurred all online, right? Did the format of your collaboration affect, I mean, obviously it affected how you work together, but were there any advantages to working like this? I mean, or would you, I mean, I guess you would have preferred to meet in person to collaborate, but how do you feel about collaborating in an all online format? Is this something worth pursuing? I mean, right now, during the pandemic, I guess we have to, but once we go back to sort of a normal or more normal state of things, would this be something interesting that you might continue doing?
I'd love to collaborate more with great pleasure. And I've already bounced one idea off Yasmin, and we shall see what happens with that. But for me, the first advantage is a bit like when we talk about remote teaching and the conversations we've had about that aspect of our work, that I'd rather do something than nothing at all. I'd rather sit here having this conversation with both of you wonderful people now on Zoom than not at all, right? And it meant that we could collaborate already, so that's a good start. I think it does change something in the form of the collaboration, because Yasmin mentioned I like to play music with, well, various people in my life, and husband and children and the band as well, and the friends. And with the band, we talked about doing stuff and it never happened. And I think that's also because we're so used to being in the same room, and then you make eye contact and then you bounce off, and there's six of us, and then you bounce off each other. And that's really hard to replicate, because you can't play live with someone on the internet. It just doesn't really work with the latency and the connections and everything. And I think we would miss too much the immediacy of that connection that we're used to having. So maybe it helped that it's the first time we try and do something like this, and that for me, I was quite clear on my role and what I needed to do. And I think like Yasmin knows her stuff, right? So we kind of just understood what each person needed to do, and we're able to build off each other in that way, meaning it can work. I don't know, how did you feel about that, Yasmin?
It's interesting, because for me, I could have only done this with you within this context, actually, because I am someone who is really held back often by the idea of like an audience and the idea of something live, and being able to curate what we did helped me a lot feel like I could put this out there. And it also, I mean, it helps to, you know, to not, you know, no one could smell my fear through the Zoom call when they were showing it on Webster's Got Talent. And I always imagine like, oh gosh, if I ever did this live, like I'd be shaking, I'd be nervous. And this was just such a nice way to relieve myself of that pressure. And to be able to, you know, really produce the music and the video and then put it out there. And so it sort of went through these various filters of like, you know, checking the boxes and making sure that we were really happy with it. And that gave me a lot of confidence. And I think also, again, because of the context, I was really keen to do it, because these sort of opportunities to collaborate and to do something as a community. At Webster, we have a lot of different events, but Webster's Got Talent is one of the primary like staples of our campus community. And so that opportunity was not something that I would take for granted ever again. And so this year, the fact that we did have that opportunity, I really wanted to do it. Now that we know how, you know, how much we should count on those chances when we do have them. So I definitely think that it was a product of its context, like we were talking about before, Juliana, and I wouldn't have done it any other year, certainly not with an original song either. So for me, that type of collaboration was the essence of it.
So let's talk about some of the silver linings, right, of the pandemic, because this is one of them. Your collaboration, but for the last year, we've been consuming forms of culture in a digital form, right? So those of us consuming things like your video, your music video, but there's been a lot of discovery through social media of art, and you know, like I said in my article, nothing struck me as much as your song. Like over the last year, like nothing hit me quite so strongly. But so, you know, we're all hoping that music festivals and concerts will be able to restart in the nearish future. But let's talk about your music video. Who came up with the visual aesthetic style of this video? I mean, there's so many components to talk about, but who was responsible for this video?
So you're saying that we're not taking credit for any parts of it. This is the one part where Sarah was like, I have no idea. Like, you just, I don't know, you do you. And that was really funny because I kept on telling her, like, I don't know, just film yourself. And she was like, no, give me a checklist of what exactly you need from me. And so we sort of did that. And I wanted it to be as simple as possible, in a way that didn't take away from the piece. So I didn't really want it to be a whole music video per se. And I wanted it to sort of read as a performance still, because I thought, especially since we were showing it at a talent show, it would be nice if there was an element of, you know, replicating a live-ish performance in some ways. So I told Sarah, you know, just film yourself singing it at your mic and playing it on your piano. Like, just like, that's all we need. And I did the same thing. And then I thought it would be lovely to have us all in the same frame instead of doing sort of like a jump cut to each other at different points in the song, because again, that would replicate the idea of us all sharing a stage. Even though of course there can't be two of me or two of Sarah, which there are in the piece, there are four squares. But so yeah, it was all about replicating in a way that still made use of the fact that we could create a video of it, but still replicating a live performance in the sort of spirit of it, in the fact that we're all together, in the fact that we're not always in sync and you can look at different things at different times, but that it's not a separate performance at any point for either of us.
And how long did the filming take?
How long did it take?
How many hours of footage did you end up with and have to edit?
I'll be honest, I took that a couple of times. Like, I tried to, like I told you, like, this style also comes with the idea of, like, not judging yourself when you do it. So I only recorded the vocals once, for example, and I just went with my, like, first take of the vocals. The video, though, I recorded a couple of times because I was like, oh, no, that angle isn't good, or I don't look great there. So I did do it, I think, maybe three or four times, the video in itself. And then the editing took a little bit longer, but yeah, so I'd say I have about four takes of me singing Dreamer's Water, which was also part of the reason why I was like, you know what, I'm just going to use a couple of these at the same time and put myself in it more than once as well, because I did have several recordings of me singing it. How long did it take? I think it took Sarah longer because there was, you know, there were the children and there was husband, and
I'm laughing because it was overall chaos. And I decided I would FaceTime Yasmin because she's the filmmaker, right? She knows about like shots and like how to do all this stuff. So I thought, okay, I would show her what I would film so we can get like the angle right. And I actually recorded it on an electric piano because the sound quality would be better. So I did that because we know about sound quality and its importance for this kind of thing. But then we decided visually is more interesting for me to fake playing my grand piano in my lounge. It's so funny. It was a chaotic moment on a Sunday night when the children were kind of like tired at the end of the day and the puppy was having his funny half hour and my husband is next to me with like a child's easel trying to balance the camera, trying to film me pretending to play this song. Thank goodness we could mute that and you could just play the recording of the song over the top. But yeah, I had to do that in one take. There was not an option of doing it a lot of times, but it worked out okay in the end. And I like that you put it in black and white. I think that's, yeah.
One of the parts that cracked me up was while we were on FaceTime with one another, is just your husband scolding us because our genius idea was tape your phone to the chair. That way it'll film you at a good angle. He was like, you're gonna ruin your phone. And I was just laughing so much seeing the chaos unfold at the Grosso household. And I
was like, to be honest, he was probably right. That was not gonna work. But yeah.
When I proposed it, you were like, yes, I'll tape my phone to the chair. That's a good idea.
Anything. How could this work? Oh, and I filmed the water because I decided there should be water.
I was going to ask you about that.
I'm going to film water because I live close to the forest here in Versoix, and it's really beautiful. So I thought, I was on a walk, the puppy is pulling the leash, and I thought, okay, I'm going to at least film moving water.
There's a sense of place in the video. That's nice.
There you go. Yeah.
Versoix. But nobody helped you with the filming, right? So Yasmin was just consulting, was telling you what to do with the angles and everything.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, it's really nice sound and video editing. Was that a lot of work, or are you sort of just skilled at it from having been practicing for a while now?
So I am lucky that I think I've reached a point where a lot of it is second nature in terms of the technical aspects of it. Editing still remains, though, like one of the hurdles for me in terms of film production, because it does take time and space on my computer, which I never seem to have. I'm one of those people with like a desktop full of 1,000 different files. So it's that sort of aspect sometimes gets a little bit tiresome, but it's a lot of fun for me. It's also one of my favorite parts of production. And yeah, I mean, it did take some time and some consideration, but a lot of it was already sort of there. Like Sarah said, a lot of it was like one take, because we did want it to be authentic and for it to feel authentic, even though she's miming playing on her grand piano and I'm actually lip syncing in both of the videos that appear. It's not me singing live either. So it's sort of this like constructed authenticity in a way, yeah. Sort of ironic way. So yeah, we sort of did it in like one take shots, and there were only like sort of maybe 24 takes that I had to like go through. So it wasn't that challenging in the end. And yeah, it just sort of felt, it felt like such a personal process, and at the same time, something so collaborative that the joy of doing it, took away from anything technical that got in my way.
So what's going to be the afterlife of the song? How will it continue to exist? What's going to happen to it?
Apple Music and global success.
Yeah, I was going to say we have very different ideas of where this is going. She's like, put it on YouTube. Put it on Apple Music.
Sarah sounds like an agent. Like, do it.
I said this to her the other day. I'm going to stop sounding like your agent now.
Well, yeah. Yeah. And how... So, I mean, seriously.
So I can't really imagine myself... It feels so out of character to do that. I did put it on my Instagram page, which was like a huge move for me because I sort of hide away from stuff like that and putting stuff on social media. So it exists there and it will exist in that space until I get too nervous and maybe remove it. I think that it's going to be on YouTube somewhere. I think Webster said that they were going to publish it. If not, maybe I'll publish it on mine. But I think that it's... life will sort of, its lifespan will be determined by the people who at Webster did listen to it and whether they continue listening to it, because I don't think that I'll share this with a lot of other audiences. But I don't know, I feel like Sarah's gonna tell me off for saying that.
I'm gonna tell you off too.
yes and no, because I think it's your creative work, you know, so it's up to you to decide what you do with your creative work. But to have the confidence that you can share this with other people if that's something you choose to do.
Yeah, it was a validating experience.
Yeah, exactly. But then obviously after from that point onwards, it's your choice.
Is the Sorry, what did you say, Sarah?
Is it the single of your first album, maybe something like that, right?
Yeah, right.
Well, I wanna say thank you for putting it on your Instagram, because that's exactly where I found it, and I would have been denied the experience that you know about now that I had. That was very inspiring. So. So thank you, Yasmin and Sarah, for being such wonderful guests on this podcast.
Thank you.
And I hope that you collaborate again in the future so that you continue to inspire us, so that we can be inspired and do, more creative work of our own as well.
Thank you so much.
Final word, Sarah? You look like you had something to say.
Yes, because I wanted to say that I obviously really enjoyed doing this experience with Yasmin, but for me, it's kind of a broader metaphor for what we do with all of our students. And, that's what we're here for, right? To accompany, all of you who might be listening. And each of you has, a talent and something special and our job is to help you, build confidence and to share that with everybody. And we saw that, at Webster's Got Talent, there were other students sharing their talents this year and in previous years as well. And I'm always blown away by the talent of our students. And I look forward to seeing more in the future.
Yeah, I will definitely say that this is such a Webster thing that happened here. This sort of intimate collaboration and intimate sense of community is something that I think is really unique to Webster. And I can say that with previous university experiences. If any students are listening to this podcast, we're so lucky to have professors like Juliana, like Sarah, who uplift students, uplift student talent, and take on the opportunity. Go for tea after class with your teacher, which is how Sarah and I formed this sort of mentor and mentee relationship that we have now, which I think is going to last me a lifetime. So I'm really grateful to Webster for all of this sort of stuff. And, the podcast too. I mean, all of this is just so wonderful and so encouraging. And it's really unique to this university. So it's really nice to experience that.
Thanks.